Hey, folks, and welcome to Take Me Into the Ball Game, where we grade baseball movies on the 20 to 80 scouting scale used for baseball prospects. Really and truly, the use I think Branch Rickey always imagined. My name is Ellen Adair, and I am joined this week by the erudite and affable Noah Gattell. And if you are not tuning in because you are a fan of Noah's and you don't know who he is, Noah is an author, a journalist, a film critic, and also a long-suffering Mets fan, truly the only kind of Mets fan that exists, let's be honest. And he has been published in, among other things, the New York Times, The Ringer, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and most recently, his book, Baseball the Movie, which came out this past month. And he is truly a luminary of the intersection of baseball and film and one of the most perfect people to get to have on this podcast. You can follow him on Twixter at Noah Gattell. I am so honored to have you. Welcome, Noah.
Thank you, Ellen. It is a delight and an inevitability to be here with you today.
I'm glad that you feel that way. I feel like it also is like it was meant to be, right? We didn't know that it was going to happen, but here we are stepping into the thing that was always meant to happen. So today we are going to be talking about the 2008 film Sugar to have another scout in to give their grades. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about your movie, your book, Baseball the Movie. I don't know, maybe it will become a movie someday. Since we are, of course, lucky enough to have the author of Baseball the Movie here with us, as it was always meant to happen. I absolutely loved reading your book, by the way. And I know that I have said this to a video, but I haven't actually said it to your face. It is just an absolutely wonderful book. It is here. I have my advanced copy. It's not just an exploration of the films or of baseball, but it's specifically the ways in which the films were and are reflections of our society, which I just thought was so interesting and so smart. So to that end, I would love to start by turning that question around and looking at how you are also a reflection of baseball. So how do you think that being a baseball fan has shaped your life?
Well, I've thought a lot about this, especially in the last 5 or so years. On one level, look, I became a baseball fan when I was 6 years old. I saw the ball go through Bill Buckner's legs and I was like, oh, life is good. Great things happened to me.
Sure.
And I didn't know that
there was nobody in the universe having the opposite reaction to that moment. No, at that time. It was all about you.
It did not occur to me that my 6-year-old self was enjoying it. There were like 95-year-old Red Sox fans who were like, my whole life has been a waste.
I've made all the wrong choices.
Yes, exactly.
And you were like, oh my gosh, yeah, being a Mets fan, this seems great. This is going to be great. This is going to work out so well.
Yeah. I do sometimes wonder if like I would be a happier person if that had never happened, you know, and I never had that expectation that their magic, you know, the universe bent towards me specifically. But, you know, so there's that. And like being a baseball fan since I was 6 years old, it's like it's the prism through which I view the world in many ways. Like when I get up in the morning, I check 5 baseball sites and 1 regular news site. So it is who I am in many ways. But I, especially as like I've gone through life as a Mets fan and having to deal with the losing, the constant, you know, high expectations, poor results, and just the LOL Mets moments like that happen every year. Like it's been hard. It has not been an easy life in that regard. And I don't say that as a joke. Like I say it as reality. And I had a moment a few years ago where it was after a really bad Mets loss. I wanted to burn all of my Mets gear in the driveway. And this was my actual plan. I gathered it all up. I was like, I'm going to burn it because I need to disassociate from this because I am not happy being a Mets fan. And my then wife convinced me to donate it instead of burning it because she was a nice person. And I
did. About the environment, really.
Yeah, that's true. That's really what it was. But she was happy for me to dissociate from my identity too, because honestly, being a Mets fan like wasn't great for our marriage either, like, and how angry I would get after losses. And since then, I have worked very hard to become a healthier fan. And I'm challenged in that every single day of the season, because it is almost never good to be a Mets fan. And there are opportunities to be angry almost all the time. And in that way, I mean, it's true what they say. I am a living embodiment of it, that baseball is a character building exercise. And I really believe that if you do it right and you work hard at it, it can be like the best way towards a happier life and towards enlightenment and towards peace, because it constantly challenges you in your efforts to find those things. And I'm not there yet, but I'm way healthier than I was 5 years ago. So that is the way that I have tried to make myself a better person, is by becoming a better fan.
I love that so much. And I love it particularly because, and this may not surprise you, there's so many things that you've said that I personally identify with. I certainly identify with waking up and looking at five different baseball sites, right? Like if I just open up my Google, like, and there's all of the sort of different, which site would you like to go to? Like, it's all baseball sites. So like, did you want to go to PitcherList? Did you want to go to Baseball Savant? Like, maybe you wanted to go to Gmail, but like mostly it's otherwise it's all baseball. And I love that you were like, I need a ritual to cleanse myself. Like, I'm gonna, that's the degree to which I need to purge myself of my unhealthy love of baseball. And obviously unhealthy love of baseball is my brand, so I identify with that as well. But yeah, I really love, in some ways, any way that we can be like, how is this thing an invitation to be a better person, right? And how is whatever the thing is, how can I extrapolate that into other areas to also figure out how that can make me a better person? I do feel like in some ways, I also have been on a little bit of a journey, though despite unhealthy love of baseball being my brand, to kind of like unattach a little bit, to be like, how can I celebrate the wins without dwelling in the losses, which is like a little bit of the game of life, as you were saying. Yeah.
That's so, exactly it. And I just, I want to say, you know, I know you're obviously a famous Phillies fan. I went down to
not
Philadelphia.
That famous.
Well, you're one of the most famous to me for sure. And
I appreciate that.
I went down to Philadelphia for work like a month ago or something. And I went to a Phillies game and I bought a Phillies hat and I put a picture of myself wearing a Phillies hat on Twitter and on Instagram. And the replies from my friends were like, my friends, like smart people who were like, you know, F Philadelphia, it's a terrible city, a terrible team. I'm like, what are you talking about? If you were born in Philadelphia, you'd be a Phillies fan and you would think the complete opposite. I don't know how smart people when it comes to sports can be so obtuse, but that's been my goal in doing things like that. Like you just said, I wear a Phillies hat and I try to say, hey, okay, today I'm rooting for the Phillies, even though most of the rest of the year, like I am rooting against them. And that's exactly what it does for me, is it allows me to still enjoy the Mets victories, but I've dissociated enough from identifying with the Mets, like wearing the uniform of my enemy, you know, helps me dissociate from identifying with the Mets. And so when they do lose, I don't take it so hard.
Yeah. It's so funny because I look, my whole life, I have been tutored to love baseball above all, because in some ways, like baseball, the whole thing will rarely let you down. Every once in a while, obviously it will. We've gone through a few periods of disillusionment with things in baseball, some of which you discuss in your book. But I didn't even realize the way in which my parents, specifically my dad, I think, teaching me to be like, no, you can love good players on other teams. And you can be happy by just being like, this random matchup of this team to this team, who are you going to root for? And then be happy when the team that you decided to root for randomly wins. that I think that that's been a way that I've kind of been inoculated against that. On the other hand, like the Phillies are my life partner, and I do live and die by the Phillies a little bit.
You're so lucky that you had a parent like that. I know you want to move on, but I just got to finish this thought.
No, please.
You're so lucky you had a parent like that and not one who just taught you that tribalistic way of looking at baseball. But I do think that's within us all, because I find that when I watch a baseball game, or really any sporting match, although usually it's baseball, no matter who's playing, I inevitably end up rooting for someone. You know, your body just sort of tells you, okay, this is who I'm rooting for.
Yes. Thank you. And sometimes I'm even surprised. Like I would have thought that I was rooting for a team. And then I'm like, oh, I find it like just really hard to root against the Cubs for some reason. Anyway, I I completely agree. And it's surprising to me the number of people who don't seem to understand that, right? Like that I will go to some random game and, okay, an example is like, I was in Atlanta shooting on a television show and I saw the Red Sox play in Atlanta. Now, I lived in Boston for 7 years, so I actually have great affection for the Red Sox, but I wore Red Sox gear to the game. The Phillies are not playing. And the amount of, like, I want to say hate, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it, like, anger that I got for people being like, how dare you? And I'm like, I'm still like, the Phillies are not in this game. In this particular game, I'm rooting for the Red Sox. They're playing Atlanta. Like, that shouldn't even be a difficult concept. Mm-hmm. You too are probably also rooting for the Red Sox right. to beat Atlanta if you're a Phillies fan. Anyway, it was, it's strange. It's strange to me. But I wrote an article about this, about my complex flowchart of baseball allegiances at Fenway Nation. Like, I mean, gosh, maybe it's even like 7 years ago now, a very long time. And so when people are confused, I just send them the link to the article. I'm like, this is how I was raised.
That must save you a lot of time.
It does. It really does. So the main thing that I want to talk to you about, although this is all salient, this is all important background information, is your book. Mm. And I'm just very curious how the idea for this book came to you. Or is that just simply because you live your life with your twin loves of baseball and film?
I mean, yeah, basically that's the short answer, is that it was time for me to write a book. And I was like, what is a book that hasn't been written? And what is a book that I want to read? And what is a book that I would not mind spending 3 years plus of my life with? Because that's what it is, from proposal to press tour. But I've always been interested in this idea of sort of the underlying values of films. When I first started writing mm-hmm. about film, it was like I wrote exclusively on the underlying politics of movies. And I often had as like a conservative versus liberal binary, which was very limiting to me. And I ultimately abandoned that. But I did write a book that never got published and sort of did this thing I do with the baseball movie, but I did it with the Western, which is also another fundamentally American genre.
Yeah.
So I kind of trained myself like going through that process. I spent about a year on that book. But it lends itself even better to the baseball movie, A, because people still like these movies more than they like Westerns, I think, and people are more interested in them. And just because baseball is the national game and it just sort of can't help but reflect the country's values at the time it was made. So it all just seemed like a natural fit for me. And I was very fortunate that I found one agent and one publisher who agreed.
Yes. Yeah. And I do think that your stipulations for your kind of checklist of things about why should I write a book and what should the book be, I think those are good and should universally apply to everybody. So, you know, obviously you're so familiar from the get-go with, I would imagine, a lot of these films and with your essential ethos, which I think is so smart and interesting to look at films through. What does this film tell us about the society that made it? I mean, ultimately, that's kind of the question about any piece of art. But since you had so much to bring to it, what kind of surprised you the most that you discovered in your process of researching and writing the book?
There was a lot. I mean, the thing about baseball is it's been around for so long that there's never a shortage of new information to any of us, you know, stuff we didn't know or hadn't learned. And some of it was embarrassing. I'm embarrassed how little I knew about the Negro Leagues, to be honest with you. And I know, like, in the last 10 years or so, there's been a real push to you know, bring that into the light. And so I forgive myself for not knowing it in the 90s and early 2000s when I was a youngin. But I, you know, in researching Jackie Robinson's story, for example, both the mm-hmm. Jackie Robinson story and his overall story, I didn't really grasp the kind of bittersweet nature of integration and how what it meant to decimate the Negro Leagues and how those were hugely important Black cultural centers and Black-owned teams. And, you know, that there was such a more complicated version of that story of integration that the Jackie Robinson movies just never touched and like were never interested in telling. And that was really eye-opening to me because it taught me, well, what is the story they're telling and why are they telling it this way? And then it also opened up this, you know, other area of personal research for me in learning about the Negro Leagues, which is now much easier to do than it was 10 or 15 years ago. And then, you know, the other thing that struck me as I researched all these movies is just how persistent the myth was that baseball movies don't make money. You know, at the very beginning of the book, I talk about The Pride of the Yankees. That's the movie I start with. And the first lines of the book are a quote from Samuel Goldwyn, which is, baseball movies are box office poison. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, Pride of the Yankees made a lot of money, was nominated for 11 Oscars, and yet still they were considered box office poison. Even after The Bad News Bears was a massive hit, they were considered box office poison. Bingo Long made money and they were considered box office poison. And it really wasn't until The Natural that that myth was overturned. And yet I think it's now come back in the 2010s. I think once again, baseball movies are considered box office poison. So it's just fascinating how they are like a perpetual underdog and have to overcome that reputation time and time again.
Yeah, well, and I feel like as I was listening to you rehearse the history of that, of course, which I had read about in the book as well, it's interesting just the persistence of certain narratives, right? Mm-hmm. That they're just sort of convenient. And so people continue to believe them despite having all kinds of evidence to the contrary. And I think that that is, we'll get to it in just a little bit, but I think that that is, it's a thing that has a stranglehold on Hollywood, on the film industry generally right now. I feel like the idea of what is profitable versus what is not profitable and how hard it is to make those falsehoods die. Anyway, when you were talking a little bit about the Negro Leagues and the Jackie Robinson movies, one point that I feel like you make very well in the book is, you know, essentially the reason that that's not the story that we have received from these movies, and I would say in some ways from the story of integration generally, is because essentially we've gotten a story that's about white people empowering black people, as opposed to what it really was, which was white people disempowering black people by essentially disbanding the Negro Leagues instead of a true integration of the whole black-led organization, just kind of like stealing from it in order to make their own teams better. But I have kind of a wacky question to ask you about the Jackie Robinson films, because there are so many films made about Jackie Robinson, and so many of them are really interesting, unlike, for example, some of the films made about Babe Ruth, which are not. So an intellectual exercise here. Can you cast your ideal Jackie Robinson film using the people in Jackie Robinson films over the decades? So first, who's your ideal Jackie?
I'm sorry, I'm not going to come up with a more interesting answer here, but the answer is Denzel. Spike Lee almost made a Jackie Robinson movie in the 90s with Denzel Washington. He put the script out there during the pandemic because he's like, this is never getting made. Because by the time he got the financing for it, which took a very long time, Denzel was too old to do it. But I would love to see it, because the problem with so many portrayals of Jackie are that they don't show his anger. And they show him as this preternaturally genteel person for the most part. You know, like 42 has that one moment where he slams the bat against the wall, but that's pretty much it. Denzel has such great utility with anger. The anger in his eyes is like so strong, and he could play both. You know, he could play the restraint and he could play the anger at the same time. And I think he would have been fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the most interesting answer you could possibly have given. You, in fact, went off the board to a movie that wasn't even made. My answer, which I think also is because it would give a little bit more of Jackie's anger, would be Andre Brower from The Court Martial of Jackie Robinson. That's who I'm casting in my Jackie Robinson film. So who would you cast as Branch Rickey?
Okay. I was thinking about dream casting from any movie, not just from Jackie Robinson movies. So I gotta rethink this a little bit. Because the person Branch Rickey most resembles is John Goodman, but he never played him in a movie, so that doesn't count. I liked Edward Herman.
Also my pick. Yeah. I thought Edward Herman, this is from The Soul of the Game, a 1996 film for folks who maybe haven't seen it. Yeah, I thought he was spectacular in that film.
He's a great actor. He has that upper crust way about him, and he's very kind. He has a very kind sensibility at the same time. I mean, I thought Harrison Ford was good, but it definitely tipped over into caricature, I think, a few
times. It did. It did. Yeah. We talked a lot about it on our episode about 42, but it essentially taught me something about the kind of actor that Harrison Ford is, i.e. like, he's not a transformative actor, right? There are actors who are wonderful because they're very good at being themselves, and there's actors who are wonderful because they're very good at becoming somebody else. And I was like, oh, Harrison Ford's the first kind of actor. And I don't put any shade on either kind. It's just two different kinds of actors.
Yeah, it seemed like he was gunning for that Oscar, maybe a little bit. Yeah, maybe.
What about, who would you cast as Ray? Rachel, Jackie's wife.
I mean, I really liked, is it Nicole Beharie? Is that how her name is pronounced?
I think so, as far as I know. I don't know her personally.
I don't either, but I think she's beautiful. I think she's charming. I think she's strong. She was in 42, of course. The chemistry between her and Bozeman was terrific, too. And I have no doubt if time warp were available, she could have had the same chemistry with a young Denzel.
Yes. Yeah. I thought you were going to say with Jackie Robinson himself from the 1950 film, the Jackie Robinson story. I would pick Ruby Dee, who played Rachel in the Jackie Robinson story from 1950, except for that, unless this is a film that also has Jackie's mom in it, because of course, Ruby also plays Jackie's mom in the court martial of Jackie Robinson. So I would, in that case, put her as the mom and put Nicole Beharie as Rachel. But if there's no mom, then it's Ruby Dee. This one is not so tough, but I do have to say, who's your Wendell Smith?
Is there more than one?
There's not. I don't think there's more than one.
Well, he's an important actor in the baseball movie because he was also in the movie we're here to talk about today. But his name is Andre Holland.
Oh, obviously. Andre Holland in everything, please. Yeah, it's so unfair and unfortunate that it's the only Wendell Smith. What about Clyde Sukeforth? Any opinions?
Yeah, I don't have one for that. I'm eager to hear your thoughts.
Sure. I'm going to go Toby Huss from 42.
Yeah.
And I mean, personally, I think I want a lot of the supporting cast from 42. Like, Bozeman is also fantastic in the film. Mm-hmm. I just think Brower is better. But like, Alan Tudyk as Ben Chapman, it's such a gutsy, like, breathtaking performance. And yeah, just John McGinley and Hamish Linklater and Christopher Maloney, Burt Shotton. It's a great film.
I would like to see a great Christopher Maloney is terrific as Leo Durocher, but I think we could do better still. As I was dream casting this in my mind, I wanted Leonardo DiCaprio to play Leo Durocher in like Wolf of Wall Street.
Oh yes,
I thought that would be fantastic.
Yeah, just especially actually, I would say Leonardo DiCaprio right now. Right. Mm-hmm. Like just enough of that, like ladies man, slightly on the decline. You know what I mean? Yeah,
exactly. Right.
Perfect. So these are all relatively good movies. I'm curious, what was the worst movie that you watched? Or if this is a distinction that matters to you, which one made you the most miserable? Also, picking one is too hard. You can name a couple or three.
I'll name one, but I'll also just point you to the final chapter of my book, which is about faith-based baseball films. And now I didn't know this was actually a category of baseball film that has sprung up in the last 15 years or so, mostly like direct to streaming films that are like have evangelical themes and are marketed towards evangelical audiences. And in many cases are like cast and crewed by evangelical people who do not, no, they don't exist in Hollywood. They're like their own little ecosystem. And would you believe it? They're not as good as the rest of the actors and crew in other movies. Now, a couple of them are okay, I'll be honest with you. But typically those that have filmmakers who don't exist solely in that world. But there are a few that when you watch them, you think this might be the worst movie ever made. And I will name one of them. It is called One Hit from Home. And I gotta say, I don't remember exactly what it's about, but I'm pretty sure like many of these, it's about a baseball player who is an alcoholic and his life is going off the tracks. And in some way or another, God helps him put it back. And this might be, they often have like a kind of D-list star who's like has a small role in it. This might be the one with Jeremy London. I'm not sure. Or it might be the one with Vivica A. Fox, but there's always somebody like that in one of these movies. And I just do remember that one being among the worst of a not very good mini genre to begin with.
Well, I will have to decide if I have the stomach for it, because I think, you know, my three least favorite baseball films that I've seen are The Benchwarmers, The Winning Team, and The Babe, which I would bet are all much, much better than a lot of those films that you had to watch.
They're low on my list, but there are a few below it. Have you seen The Bad News Bears Go to Japan?
I have not. No, I have seen the first two Bad News. Obviously, the first one is a masterpiece, but like the second one, a decline, but not terrible. There's the second half of that movie, actually pretty good. It's just the first half that has a lot of problems. Anyway, so apparently the Bad News Bears going to Japan. I mean, because I feel like that might be on the list. I might get to that one.
It's so bad. I mean, Tony Curtis as a replacement for Walter Matthau is not acceptable in any way. And it focuses mostly on like a courtship between Kelly Leake and like a young geisha in Japan. And it is it doesn't end with the baseball game. I mean, there's very, very little actual baseball. And it just like takes everything that was good about the first one and gets it completely wrong.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, because there's no way that we could possibly have a movie about a bunch of people going to another country if they weren't trying to like, in some ways, make a conquest, make a like romantic conquest of a person there. Anyway.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So another film that is actually not any of my least three favorites, but is perhaps arguably worse than some of them, is Ed, which is a truly terrible film. And you do mention a few times the horrificness of Ed, but I want to know what you make of the fact that David Mickey Evans is responsible for both The Sandlot and Ed, which is not something you ever spelled out in the book. And I wondered if you were just kind of trying to skirt the issue a little bit.
Well, what I make of it, and some of your listeners are not going to like this very much, is that I don't think The Sandlot's a very good movie either.
I love it with the hot takes. Yes, hot takes.
It's not as bad as Ed, obviously, but I'm not a fan of unexamined nostalgia. And that's what The Sandlot is to me. It is just a concentrated dose of nostalgia. And I could wax poetic about why that's dangerous, why, especially when it comes to baseball narratives, we need to be mindful of nostalgia that is unexamined. And I could give examples of a lot of other films, baseball films, that are nostalgic, but do examine that nostalgia and critique that nostalgia. But I will just say that as far as my personal tastes go, I've never liked that. I don't like A Christmas Story, and I don't really like The Sandlot either. Although in my chapter on The Sandlot in the book, I do start out by saying some very nice things about it before I get to the bitterness that will surely piss people off.
I love it so much. I think I like The Sandlot more than you do, but I also don't like it as much as I think a lot of other people do. And I think to me, knowing this fact about David Mickey Evans really does reveal some fissures in The Sandlot, because it's not just the unexamined nostalgia, although I do think that that's a problem, right? I think that that generally is a problem in America. But there are so many fundamental misunderstandings of baseball in Ed. Like, it's not just that it's a bad film. It doesn't understand pitch types or like the basic structure of a baseball season or how many pitchers should be on a team, which is, of course, a classic baseball film problem. And then you kind of start to see them in The Sandlot. Like, if one kid is hitting in your Sandlot club, you actually need 10 players to fill the team, not 9. You can't be like, oh boy, we needed a 9th kid. Yeah, actually, you still need one more kid. Or most crucially for me, that the entire plot is predicated on the notion that a red-blooded American child doesn't know who Babe Ruth is. Mm-hmm. Like, what? I don't buy it.
Well, what's even worse is I think their unexplained reason for that is because he doesn't have a dad. And there's no way his mom could tell him who Babe Ruth is.
Of course not. Yes. But of course, if we're going all lack of misogyny on The Sandlot, we are not going to get into the fact that Squints basically assaults that lifeguard. And the moral of the story is it works. Yep. They get married. They have lots of babies. Anyway, I do have one bone to pick with you, which Fantastic. Is how can you not have Kevin Costner on the front of your book?
It's an oversight. There's no question. I will tell you that I did not design the cover. And when I received it, I was so scared and I was so prepped to hate it, because I've been told by people that you always hate the cover that your publishers come up with. And when I saw it, I was so relieved, because I really thought they did a great job. It looks like a poster of an old film, like a film from the 40s. They did put, like, I wasn't even sure they would even be able to put any actors on the cover. They ended up putting Redford, Gina Davis, and Tim Robbins.
Yes, for those of you who are not watching on YouTube, yes. I'm holding the book up, but yes.
I don't know why they chose Tim Robbins when they clearly could have just used Costner there. It's a mystery to me, but I don't hate looking at Tim Robbins on that cover. He's making a funny face. Maybe they were looking for some humor, and like, he definitely conveys silliness in that photo. So I do appreciate that. But my point is, I was prepped for it to be so bad that like, I wasn't in a place to complain at all. I was just like, thank you for not screwing this up.
This is a gift that your life as a Mets fan has given you. For example, right? Like, look at you becoming a more evolved human being out of your lifetime of Mets fandom. Yeah. So if you were going to pick three people to be on the cover of the book, who would you pick?
Well, in my heart or for selling in the book?
Maybe in your heart. In your heart.
Billy Haywood from Little Big League, for sure.
Okay.
Oh, gosh. I mean, probably Crash from Bull Durham, now that you mention it. And I'm a big fan of David Strathairn's, you know, his Bedroom Eyes from 8 Men Out. He's like just such a hunk, I think. And I would love to represent 8 Men Out on the cover in some way.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's true that would be nice for having a kind of a period feel to it, right? Mm-hmm. Because yes. I think for me, I'm picking Kevin Costner as Crash Davis. And then I guess I just, as the, you know, one of the hosts of this podcast, would love to have another 6 Degrees of Baseball hero on there. I think I would do, oh, by the way, I would keep Dottie Hinson for sure.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Yes, she's staying. And mm-hmm. so then I'm going to do Crash Davis. And then I would have James Earl Jones in Bingo Long.
And that
would be my choice. And I realized that would mean that I would have chosen three catcher characters, but I am not sorry.
Catchers are very important. Catchers are like the main character of the baseball movie.
It's why we have a whole category for it, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So let's move along to some of the excellent 21st century baseball films. You do a long interview with Richard Linklater, who is, for those who might not know, perhaps most famous as the writer-director of Dazed and Confused, also Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Boyhood, just an absolute genius as a writer and a director, and also responsible for the truly, truly wonderful Everybody Wants Some! ! So if I can geek out for a second, like, how did you make that happen? And what was it like to get to talk to him?
Well, I heard him say on another podcast or an interview, because somebody wrote a oral history of Dazed and Confused, and I think he did some interviews with them, like a whole book. And he said, you know, I can't say no when there's a young person who's passionate about something. And I was like, that's me. I'm a semi-young person with a project. But I also knew that, like, his films weren't going to quite fit into the overall narrative of the book, because I don't know that his films, I mean, you could stretch and say that they tell some story of America. I think as a whole, they do more than they do individually. Mm. So I'm like, I got to find a way to fit him in here. And I came up with this idea of having like interstitials in between the big sections where I could talk about some baseball movies that don't fit the overall narrative. But I'm like, I have to get an interview with him, because it's the only way I'm going to be able to talk about him in the book. It's the coolest way to talk about him in the book. And I tried to work a few connections and it didn't work at all. So I had to go the traditional route, and I called his production company and I got the email address for his assistant. And I wrote to her and I said, I'm writing this book. I want to make the argument in the book that Richard Linklater is the preeminent baseball filmmaker, not just of our time, but of all time. And I have to interview him for it. I'll take whatever amount of time you can give me with him. And eventually she wrote back and said, yeah, okay, we're going to do this. It's going to take some time, but we'll get it done. And it took 10 months, 10 months of emails back and forth. And we were down to like 2 months before my deadline. And that was, we finally got it in about 6 weeks before my deadline. I got about an hour and a half with him over Zoom. She had told me I would only have an hour, but he was very open and loose when I was talking to him. And he was an interesting interview. And I've subsequently heard that he doesn't like doing in-depth interviews. And I kind of felt that way when I started, because he has that Texas charm, very casual way of being, that I think he uses a little bit to try to ward off difficult questions. He just shrugged off some of my questions and he was like, yeah, maybe, yeah, maybe. A lot of that going on. But eventually we broke through and I think we found some interesting things to say. And you know, ultimately we ended up vibing out on baseball. I mean, he's one of these guys who just loves to talk baseball. And once we got into that, and he was complaining, you know, to me that David Ortiz is in the Hall of Fame and Roger Clemens isn't, I mean, I knew I was with one of my people. And I think he felt the same way.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I love that. The most old-fashioned persistence is how you made that happen. I did know that he didn't love interviews, and that was part of the reason why I was like so excited. And it's for anybody who has not already picked up a copy of this book, you really need to, for any number of reasons. But yeah, it's a fantastic interview, and I do think really it contributes so much to the book overall. As a sort of a full picture. And I think it's also great to kind of in there get the real perspective of a filmmaker as well, in his own words, and also as a baseball fan, right? As somebody who's in the Venn diagram with the two of us of like huge baseball nerd and huge film nerd.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And one thing that you touch on in your interview with Linklater, and we teased this a little bit earlier, is why you think there haven't been big budget baseball movies made recently. Can you talk a little bit about that, about where you sort of came to on that question?
Yeah, I think there are two big reasons. One, and this is something that has plagued the baseball movie for a long time, is that there is a perception that they don't perform well internationally. And international box office has become a more important part of the overall calculus of if a movie will get made. And outside of, I think it's Moneyball and was it The Natural? Or there's two movies that have performed well overseas. And they're movies that had a big, beautiful movie star to put on the poster. And that helps a lot. But a lot of baseball movies are ensembles and they don't always have like one huge star in them. So that's not easy. Many others, including Major League, including, it is Bull Durham. They didn't even get any international release. So there really is a perception out there that baseball films just don't do well overseas. And I think the other one, sadly, is that young people today in America are not as into baseball as they used to be. I saw a poll that 11% of Zoomers say that baseball is their favorite sport. And that's obviously a steep decline. And I guess for studio executives, what young people think is pretty important. So that's a problem in terms of the overall mainstream big budget studio movies. But then you see a movie like Sugar, you know, for example, and you're like, hey, you can make a great baseball movie with not a lot of money. And I don't totally understand why that's not happening.
Yeah, it's such a great question. And yes, I do think like consideration of, for example, Chinese people don't really like baseball. So how are we going to sell our movie in China? Which I think that's particularly like, if only Chinese people loved baseball as much as Japanese people love baseball, like it might genuinely be different. This is a thought that I've had all the time. And yeah, it's interesting to me. And I feel like I found myself having this question, having read your book, having sort of walked through your beautiful synthesis of the decades vis-a-vis our society and baseball movies, because I feel like currently with young people, with the society in general, but with young people, it's about a loss of a collective belief in the American dream. So looking back on media from a decade ago, the Obama era optimism feels sometimes cringy and sometimes like just like it's a million miles away. Like, remember when at least some of us thought that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice? Mm-hmm. But millennials and Gen Z are two generations that aren't seeing the American dream exist for them in the way that it did for our parents, and don't necessarily have faith in the viability of a revolution that's going to change things, because we've just seen how much the machine of society squashes that over and over again. And, you know, look, I wasn't alive in the 70s, so I can't say. You do make a really interesting argument about the 70s films coming out of the disillusionment of the Watergate era. But I feel like there's almost greater disillusionment going on right now than there even was then, in a country reeling from like Trump and MAGA extremism, and which an ongoing problem, obviously, and the pandemic. And we feel out of sorts with a kind of happy, dreamy genre of the classic mm-hmm. baseball film. Like, I have an idea for a baseball movie, but it's not the one that MLB wants to make. And because of that, it's not the one that would get the budget that it would need to tell the story. And, you know, my idea is a lot more about how things are messed up, but we try to persevere anyway, mm-hmm. you know? And in some sense, I've just kind of been like, do you need to believe in America in order to believe in a baseball movie?
That's a brilliant point that I hadn't quite considered before. Although I think my book like dances around that point, but never quite.
I think it does. It, yeah. No, I think yeah. I got there only because of your book.
right. yeah. It's brilliant. I think you're absolutely right. I have several responses to what you just said. Regarding the last point, like, I don't know this for a fact, but I would not be surprised if MLB is reluctant and difficult to deal with in making a movie about baseball. I mean, just everything I know about them would tell me that is the case. Would Major League get made today? Like, probably not. I'm sure MLB would find a way to screw that up. So that's an obstacle. I think MLB is much dumber in some ways than they were back then. When you talk about the 70s being a similar area of disillusionment, I think it's worth noting that like there were only three baseball movies made that entire decade, really. And that was when baseball was still the number one sport in this country. So I think you're on to something, that in those times, baseball movies are a tougher sell. And then when you talk about the Obama era, you know, and the optimism, Moneyball and 42 are like the perfect movies to represent that era. I had a friend say this, and I'm going to steal it, which is that if you combine Billy Beane and Jackie Robinson, you sort of get Barack Obama. Like, he kind of is both of those things. And those movies are sort of the last gasp of American optimism when it comes to baseball, in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do think that another factor is just the issues with Hollywood, right? Like, mm-hmm. streaming has massively disrupted the profitability model for films of all kinds, because people won't go to the theaters unless it's a big blockbuster or an Oscar contender. And so, like, those are the only movies being right. made. It's not only a baseball movie problem. Like, the entire middle class of films no longer exist. And for the time being, low budget indies are being made. But honestly, the window for that as a viable business model, i.e. to make more money than, say, like the $1 million you spent on a film, people aren't buying things as one-time rentals the way that they might have even 5 years ago, because they'll just watch what's included in their streaming platforms. Yeah.
I think that's true. I would only caveat that there were a lot of sports movies made last year. Like, there were a couple basketball movies. There was Champions, and Hustle came out a couple of years ago with Adam Sandler.
There was a great movie.
I really like it. I know. There were wrestling movies last year. There were racing movies. I guess 80 for Brady was technically a football movie. So it's like they're kind of doing everything except baseball movies, which I find frustrating. But I will say, I do sense that there is something coming. You know, Night Swim came out earlier this year, which had a strong baseball component, even though it is not a baseball movie. Like, they didn't have to make that guy a baseball player with the haunted pool, but they did. And I think that's interesting. Supposedly, Darren Aronofsky's next movie is about a retired baseball player. I don't know much more about it than that. And there's a film that just premiered at Cannes called Ephes, which is an independent American film that I believe is about a men's league game on a field that is set to be demolished when the game ends. And there is some like magical realism, and like the game goes on forever or something, which it's gotten really good reviews out of Cannes so far. I'm trying to get my hands on a screener of it, but I've been unsuccessful so far, but I'm super excited about that.
I'm so excited for that movie. I'm so excited to like do a movie on our podcast that has come out relatively recently. That will be amazing. And that sounds incredible. That sounds like, I mean, magical realism is hits me right where I live. I love it so much. But while we are on the topic of baseball films of the 21st century, let us transition into talking about Sugar, which we were mentioning just a moment ago, which is, as I've always said, I think the best overall movie with baseball in it, even if it's not necessarily the one that I'm going to in January when I need a baseball fix. I do, by the way, I just want to mention, I really appreciate your campaigning for films being like, it's not a baseball movie, but like it's got baseball in it. I love that. let's add as much as we can to the possible canon of baseball movies. So as we transition, if you, gentle listener, have not seen Sugar, first of all, go watch it. We are not going to be avoiding spoilers here, and it is truly a perfect movie. However, a brief overview of the plot is that Miguel Sugar Santos is a pitcher at one of the academies in the Dominican Republic for the fictional Kansas City Knights. And the film charts his course in the Dominican Republic to a spring training invite to High A in Iowa. But then he gets injured and he struggles on returning from his injury, and he decides to leave the team to go to New York. And then the last maybe quarter of the film is him navigating New York as an immigrant and finding his community there with a furniture maker and with a lot of other Spanish-speaking players who used to be in the minor league system. So that's a basic overview if you haven't seen the film. It is a 2008 film by geniuses Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. And Eric and I already have an episode in which we talk about the team and some of the filmmaking process. So you can also go listen to that episode for that and our own scouting grades of the film, which I may or may not just be sprinkling in as Noah and I talk about his grades for this movie. If you are just joining us and you're not familiar with the 20 to 80 scouting scale, just know that 50 on the scale represents a prospect that scouts think will make it to be an everyday major league player. So it's an average, but it's like a good professional competent average. 45 is fringy. 40 is kind of like up and down from the minors to the majors. 30 and 20 are decisively not good. This skill is not exhibited. On the other end, 55 is above average, an above average major league player. 60 is excellent. 70 is a superstar, and 80 is a Hall of Famer. So, last question before we dive into your scouting grades. I have to know, who's your scouting director and what are they like?
Oh, well, I've known this person for a long time. His name is Duke.
Oh, Duke. And, legend. A legend in baseball movie scouting land.
Yeah, absolutely. Duke is, he's a great scout. Super nice man. And, Duke is not his real name. It's a nickname, but he became known as the Duke because for a long time he was such a dedicated scout, and he'd been doing it for so long that he had a nickname as King of the Road. They called him King of the Road. But then there was another guy who came along as a scout who was also known as King of the Road. And there was a lot of like joking about who you can't have two kings. One of them is the King of the Road. And so all of his friends decided he would be named Duke from now on because they just knew he could take it better than the other guy, that he was humble enough to be known as the Duke of the Road rather than the King of the Road. And that became his name. His name is Duke.
That's amazing. I never knew that story. I mean, despite obviously knowing the reputation of Duke, I didn't know that that was the origin of it. You know, I feel like he might have come out of this the best because like to just call somebody Duke, like to call somebody King.
It's not
feel
great.
As good of an overall nickname. Like you could be like, you know, yes, King, or like you're the King. But like to just be like, hey, Duke, it actually,
Duke's
I feel
Duke's
like
a cool name. And, you know, everybody's always coming for the King. Nobody's coming for the Duke.
Exactly. Well, sometimes they are, but you know, in Shakespeare. So our first tool is amount of baseball. What is your scouting grade that you're going to be faxing into Duke?
So this doesn't just mean on-field baseball, or does it mean like total baseball?
Eric has a little bit more of a kind of loosey-goosey attitude towards amount of baseball. For me, it's baseball action. So mm-hmm. I consider amount of baseball to be like there needs to be a ball and a glove involved in mm-hmm. action, or a ball and a bat, or something that is standing in for those things, right? So like a stick ball yeah. counts as baseball, even though there's not, even if it's not an official baseball and an official baseball bat.
Well, then I give this movie a solid 50 because I think there is exactly the amount of baseball that it needs. Like in a weird way, this isn't like half of it isn't a baseball movie. You know, half of it mm-hmm. is an immigrant movie. And I think that's how the directors described it to me. But, you know, there is like, it doesn't give you a single moment more baseball than is necessary to tell the story. So I will give it the exact 50.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And honestly, having read your book and your chapter on this movie, doing a little advanced scouting on a scout myself, I was anticipating that your grade might be a little bit lower than ours. Eric went 70, which I think is a little high. Mm. And I went 60 myself. And it seemed to me from your chapter, like you didn't have a sense of like as much baseball goodness out mm-hmm. of this movie than I did. I think it's mostly that if it kept up the pace that it did for the first like 2/3 of the movie, we'd be looking at a Hall of Famer. But then obviously it drops off there at the end.
Yeah. What am I missing in terms of baseball, do you think?
Oh, I think it's just that there's so much baseball for the first 2/3 yeah. of the movie. There's so many instances of baseball. There's not a ton of like, oh, we're following this entire game, yeah. but there's a lot of really good baseball. You just feel like baseball is never that far away. I think Definitely. It's nice that it opens with baseball. I mean, something that I don't think I mentioned the first time we talked about this is how heavenly some of the baseball is. The opening shot of them playing baseball in the Dominican Republic, it looks like baseball heaven. Mm-hmm. And that first shot of Sugar walking out of the dugout to see the field in Bridgetown, Iowa, it is gorgeous. It's a dream. And I mean, how beautiful it is does not affect the grade per se, but I feel like the vision that the movie has really puts up the beauty of it as a foil for the brutality of how difficult it is to actually do this and make yeah. it to the major leagues. And yeah, I just think there's so much good stuff about, you know, his spike curve and like really shots of like the right curveball grip and seeing an actual curveball and a lot of touch points with baseball, right? The number of times that you see him playing.
Yeah. And I think I wasn't thinking so much about all the baseball in the beginning in the DR, which is like almost all baseball. But I agree with you that baseball is never far away. And that's why I asked the question, like, is it just on-field action or not? Because it is all centered around it. Like everything for the first 2/3 of the movie is like you're either at a baseball game or you're about to be at a baseball game.
Yeah. I mean, talking about baseball doesn't necessarily count. But yes, I just think for me, it's like it's the number of times that we just even see him, you know, doing pitching drills or something yep. like that. Nevertheless, I respect a 50. Like I see how you got there. And in some ways, Duke is going to be like, that's good. That's good. Noah's tough yeah. on this prospect. I respect that. So what about baseball accuracy for you?
I know 65 is not really a thing, but that's what
you can
I would
go for it.
Can I? Okay. I'm going to say 65. And the only reason it's not higher is I take a little issue with Sugar's velocity. I don't buy that this guy is throwing 95. And he has a nice clean motion, but I don't feel a lot of strength in his motion. And there's one shot in particular. It's when he plunks the guy that looks like he's literally just lobbed it. Like the velocity there, and that's something you can fake with filmmaking. You know, there's a way to do that. And I don't think they quite nailed that part of it. I didn't feel the speed of his pitches. And for a guy who's supposed to be a phenom, I think that's a little bit of a problem. His curveball looked good, though. I will say that. It was the fastball that I had a little bit of an issue with. Everything else, I think, is amazing.
Yeah. Look, I love this so much because both Eric and I gave this an 80 and we're just – blown away with stars in our eyes by how accurate this seemed in comparison to.
I know.
I would say, like, this,
use a scale from Ed to Sugar. I've heard you say that before. I knew this was a bold move I was making here, but I had to be true.
I know. I completely respect it. And you are right. You know, obviously, Aljenes Perez Soto, the actor who plays Sugar, was actually a middle infielder, was not a pitcher. And so it's still so plausible if you are also judging on a scale from Tim Robbins to Kevin Costner in terms of the pitching motion looks real. And yes, like, it's something that almost all baseball movies have to get around about, like, if this pitcher is supposed to be a flamethrower, can we kind of do like whip pans and stuff so that we believe that it's really fast? And I buy that, like, excellent catch. Yeah. So our next tool is storytelling.
I think this is an 80 for me, because, as I said, is this a baseball movie? Yes. Is it also an immigrant story? Yes. And the way that it is both of those things at once is what is so remarkable about it. The way that it is exactly 50% both of those things, or 100% both of those things, maybe. It's a very hard thing to do. Like, when I watch Bull Durham, even, which is, I like Bull Durham more than Sugar, but even when I watch that, I'm like, okay, here's the romance part and here's the baseball part. And, like, it's sort of segmented a little bit that way. This movie doesn't feel that way at all. It feels completely integrated. And the other thing that I appreciate about it so much, and this is so hard to do, is Sugar almost never explains his motivations in this movie. He never verbalizes them. You know, we don't even know exactly why he quits the team. There's not like one inciting incident. It's an accumulation of many things. Mm. And I think that's really hard to pull off as a filmmaker. It's easy to do and do badly, but I think it's very hard to do and do well. And I so appreciate how this movie just flows so naturally from his experience, that it all feels like it's really happening. And that's, like, it's a basic thing, but it's a really hard thing to do in a movie with such a low budget like this.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you're touching on one thing that you wrote in your book, which is, I think what you said exactly was that Sugar never really explains why Miguel wants to leave and why he doesn't want to return to the Dominican Republic. And I don't know, I think I disagree. And I agree with you, obviously, that there's not one inciting incident. But I think this film is nothing but masterfully layered set of 1001 reasons why he leaves for New York. Mm-hmm. And I do also think one of the things that makes the film so great is the fact that even though it is masterfully layered, all of those things, when that moment comes, it is surprising. Like, it's an actual little bit of film magic. Mm-hmm. Watching the film again before we were going to talk, it was so interesting for me to see, now that I knew exactly what was going to happen, the way they purposefully trick you with, like, multiple buses, and you don't realize that Miguel has gotten on a different bus until he looks over at somebody and it's just like a little white lady.
Yeah. It's like the Silence of the Lambs bait and switch scene, like before the climax, where you think she's at one house and then she's actually at the other house. It's like, it's that level of narrative mastery.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But I feel like, I do think it gives nothing but reasons for why he wants to leave. Like, these are the things that it layers in. It layers in Miguel not paying attention during the English class when the teacher is giving the lessons about, mm-hmm. about the conversation with the coach. Specifically, that it's stuff like, your performance in the mound is not as good as last year, which is an exact quote, with a lot of phrases to say back to the coach to be the perfect team player. But, like, he's not paying attention. And then that scene where Miguel and his Bridgetown coach can't communicate, in so many ways, it's sort of the fulcrum of the whole film. Like, yes, one of the things that drives him away is his injury. But if he could just communicate in that scene, things might go differently. Like, it's impeccable foreshadowing. And then we have the friend who threw 98 at AA Portland, but is now selling cell phone chargers that don't work in the Dominican Republic. And the implication is, like, there's nothing else for you to do here. Once you get to the US, you have to seize that chance, even if it's not a baseball chance. And then there's the friend who we meet kind of like joshing around in that first scene. Sugar tells him that he doesn't hustle enough. And then that friend gets cut from the academy. And then there's, like, the fact that the next day after they've all been drinking, and when he throws up on the mound during practice, and the team has Salvador take over him, for him, which is like perfect foreshadowing of what the dynamic is going to end up being. And then at spring training, we meet Jorge and we learn that he's been hurt, and that's why he's at single A instead of double A. And then Miguel goes on to see the way that he struggles and the way that he's sort of mercilessly cut. So it's like there's these three different examples of failure, like Dickensian ghosts layered into the film for me, leading up to the decision that he makes. And I also feel like, and this is something I didn't even notice until watching the film this time. So having seen the film three times, there's this lovely little subtle moment when he and Jorge are in the department store and Miguel sees this shirt made in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. And we know he's thinking about his mom because we have been so expertly shown in a like 20-second scene earlier that she's a seamstress in a factory. Mm-hmm. But it's also this moment, this clear moment of like, in his home country, people make things to be exported to here because you want to be here. And like, they export all the most talented baseball players to here. You want to live here, even if you're not playing baseball. So everything about this movie is perfect. It almost makes me speechless. It's like as perfect as any movie that I can think of, because it's the satisfaction of a complete surprise, but also the satisfaction of like, yes, but everything that has existed in this movie up until this point existed also to explain this moment happening.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I hadn't caught some of those. So I think, I mean, that's very compelling. I think a lot of the things you said also point back to sort of a tragic flaw for him, which is that he's cocky about his abilities, right? Like he hasn't failed before, really. And I think it's notable that the line that he doesn't repeat back in the English class is "you weren't as good as you were last year." Cause it's like, he can't even really, he refuses to say those words, you know? And so when he does start to struggle and when he does have an injury, he doesn't have the language in his mind or in his mouth to express that and to deal with those anxieties and those fears. I don't know why he is different than any of the other players on the team. I mean, we don't see anyone else, you know, really leave. We see people get cut, but I think you make a strong point that there isn't one reason. There are many reasons why he leaves.
Yeah, no, but I think that your point about his cockiness, I feel like that's completely in there as well, right? That he just believes that he's the best. And I never really thought about that as another reason, right? Of being that he's not able to sort of work through something that makes him feel humble, right? Yeah. So he just kind of wants to quit. And I guess I always took it as just his decision to take his chance to go to New York before they cut him and send him back to the DR. And I mean, when I first watched the movie, it made me so incredibly sad. But I loved your take on this in your book, that actually it's a positive choice for his own agency, right? Mm-hmm. In some ways, for me, I don't know why it feels less sad to be like, well, I tried my best and they cut me, but like I never quit, versus like, no, I'm going out on my own terms. I think that's just maybe two different personality types. But I think that your point that choice is related to both his agency, a good thing, and his cockiness, a bad thing, is really smart.
Yeah.
And I hadn't quite seen it that way.
It's a very complex film, and he is a complex character. Despite being able to express almost none of it himself, it still comes across from the performance and the filmmaking. And that's why the storytelling is an 80.
Oh, it's an 80. It's so good. So what do you think about the musical score?
So we're not talking about the needle drops, right? Just the score itself?
No, it's any music that is incorporated into the film.
I think I give it a 50 plus, solid average.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like a 55 or like a
yeah,
just like an optimistic
50. I'll go 55 with it. I mean, sure. I like, if we're going to do a montage, using TV on the radio for the montage is very original. I really appreciate that. I'm not like a huge fan of their music, but it's better than center field, you know?
Everything
so
is.
I'll take that. And, you know, the score itself, like, you know, we get some salsa music at times, which is fine. And we get some kind of boilerplate indie drama score in a few other places, which is fine also. I think the score does the job for the most part. The TV on the radio kicks it up above a 50, but I can't go above that anywhere else.
That's fair. Yeah. Eric and I both gave this a 60, but I think it's because I really enjoy Latin music. So all of that just made me be like, yeah, I love this. I love this score. What's your grade for acting?
I give it a 60 for acting. I mean, it's never showy ever. You know, it's very hard to do what they're doing here. There are some actors in small parts who I feel like this happens sometimes when a movie is made with this low of a budget. And there's like actors who have one or two lines and you're like, okay, we just got to get somebody. I mean, you would know, you've done a lot of acting. I haven't, but that was my impression. There are a few of those actors in the movie that bump it down a little bit, but I think the rest of the actors, like all the principals, do an incredible job fitting into the overall tone of the movie. I think it's incredibly well cast, but I don't want to diminish the talent of the actors themselves.
Amazingly well cast. Yeah. And yeah, actually, Eric and I had a 70 for this, and I was even swayed initially. I came in with an 80, and I mean, thank God I did. I changed it because Jim, my scouting director, would have been like, what is this?
Yeah, you'd lose your credibility.
Yeah, exactly, which is so important in the scouting world. But for me, it was that I didn't feel that way about any of the sort of smaller characters. I felt like 100% of the time I bought that they were those people. Mm. And so I think that's the thing that feels the most important to me in acting rather than sort of the notion of like showing me something exceptional. Yeah. Nevertheless, I bumped it down to a 70, and I understand your grade. I think Duke's going to be impressed with and he's gonna really, when he sees that 80, he's gonna be like, oh yeah, well, I mean, clearly Noah really means that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I have, that gives the 80 more credibility. Good point.
Yeah. So our next tool is, as we alluded to earlier, delightfulness of catcher character.
I'm struggling to like remember who the catcher is in this movie.
You know, he's not a huge part. However, he does exhibit some excellent catcher qualities. I think one of his larger scenes is the scene where he's being the translator between the announcer and Miguel and sort of like mistranslating on both sides.
Oh, right.
Okay, but there's also, there's a few moments where he talks him down, and in this sort of like big dust up that happens in Miguel's final game where he's taken the amphetamines and before he walks away, he does a very yeoman-like catcher job of kind of extricating Miguel and inserting himself into the melee. Yeah. So yeah, that's okay. Maybe that will ring some bells for you.
I think I give him a 50 then. I mean, the fact that I just watched this again two nights ago and didn't even remember him is not a great sign. But I think you clearly watched it a little closer than I did on this most recent viewing. But it sounds like he did a good job. That moment when he's translating is very funny. It's one of the bigger laughs in the movie, I think, actually. But, you know, given the incredible lineage of catchers in baseball movies, like we could have seen a little more here, especially given that this is a movie about a pitcher.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I also gave it a 50. I think mostly because he wasn't a larger character, but my feeling was he couldn't be a larger character because Miguel's isolation is such an important plot point almost, right? Mm-hmm. So I did love their choice, and I understood the choice for the catcher to also be Spanish speaking, but in some ways I feel like I could see there being more of a reason for why Miguel doesn't feel like he has a best friend on the team had it been just like an American born player. Nevertheless, I don't want to change anything about it, but yeah, it's something that I didn't think about the first time that I watched the movie that I did think about this time when I watched.
That's fair. And I would take this opportunity to point out, I think the film gets at this idea of best friends in a really smart way, which is that in the minor leagues, like it's hard to have them, right? Because even the ones you do have are not going to stick around for very long.
Such a great point. Yeah, it's so sad when Andre Holland's character has been sent up to AA and he's like,
doesn't even say goodbye.
I lost my friend. Yeah. Because he probably just didn't even have time to say goodbye. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hard. So we were just referencing a scene with the announcer in it. What do you think for delightfulness of announcer?
I give him a 40 because, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it's a perception issue, but I feel like minor league announcers have gotten better like in the last 10 years or so. And maybe this is a snapshot of a moment in time, but I just don't feel like that guy brings much to the table. I got to be honest.
Yeah.
He's fine.
I buy that. I like him as a character. And I think both Eric and I were very won over by just how real he felt, right? That there felt no amount of Hollywood in that guy, right? Yeah. He felt authentic. He felt like a real, just like Iowa guy. But if I was listening to his broadcast, right? Like if that's what I needed to listen to tune into, to hear the swing, I would be like, just inject a little bit more pizzazz into it, my friend.
Yeah, I think you could give him a little more personality without undermining the realism. I think that would be possible.
Yeah. I like him more as a character in this film than I would like him as an announcer. And I feel like I'm always sort of considering the two things at the same time.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's but I think duality. 40, a fair grade. Mm. So our last tool to grade here today is lack of misogyny, so phrased such that a positive score is a good thing. And what do you think?
Can we consider homophobia in this context as well?
Oh, you know, I mean,
or are we traditionally sticking to purely misogyny?
You know what? Why not? You know what? It's Pride Month. Yeah, throw it in there.
Okay. So I give it a 60 for lack of misogyny. Maybe I give it a 65. Like it definitely addresses, I think, well, okay. I have complicated feelings about this, I guess. Like the portrayal of the Christian girl, right? I think it's a really interesting character and I wanted more from her. I mean, it's kind of a common theme with me in this movie, I guess. Like my only ding on this movie is like, there's certain characters I just wanted a little more depth from, and she was one of them. And I guess there's part of me that feels like the lack of depth on that character is not—it's not misogynistic, but it's a portrayal of his isolation, right? That he doesn't get to know her, but it also just stings a tiny bit. You've got a, you know, attractive young blonde person, and she's a little bit of just like, I don't know, is she like a temptress? Like what is she exactly? She kind of flirts with him and then he gets the wrong idea and she pulls away. And I'm not going to call that misogynistic, but it like, I don't know, it rang a tiny little misogynistic bell for me that has stuck with me in a weird way. And I would say the same thing about the homophobia, the use of cocksucker, right? Which is like, this is part of baseball for sure. That word is incredibly homophobic when used as an insult. And he is taught this word as like the one thing you do not say, or you say to somebody when you're really trying to piss them off. And then he uses it in a key spot when he is angry and on amphetamines. And it is a really interesting moment because it is sort of portrayed as like a low point for him when he shouts that word at another player. And I think that's moving, but it's also portrayed as like a funny, fun moment when they're like, hey, here's the word cocksucker that you can throw around when you want to. And I feel like that's a tiny bit unexamined. So yeah. I guess I feel the same way about both of them. Or like, I'm not entirely sure how knowing the film is about those two things.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. For me, I felt like the character of the sort of the beautiful blonde granddaughter, I understood her deal. It seemed to me like she always sort of liked Miguel, but that she's just super religious. So she's not really going to take that any farther. And to me, she's given a number of opportunities to talk about how important her faith is to her and that that's the most important thing in her life and that even other things like school or a job are less important to you than your faith.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that little speech that she has at the sort of group that they go to made me understand that it's not that she's trying to lead Miguel on. I think she genuinely like has a flicker of like for him, but then doesn't actually want to do anything about it. And she's also, she's in high school, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so
So that's, she doesn't know what she wants.
She doesn't really know what she wants, right? Mm. That made sense for me as well for her of like, it's sort of fun to think about this obviously very handsome baseball player living in your grandparents' house, but like actually doing something is kind of like, oh, I don't know about that. So that didn't ring any misogyny bells for me. I think one of the reasons we were both at a 60, for me, it's just that because there's really only one main character and that main character is a man, even though there's a lot of, I think, well-rounded, plausible female characters around him, there's just not another female character to balance the weight that Sugar has in the film. And I don't think we brought up the cocksucker situation at all, which it always makes me think about, is it a George Carlin bit where he's like, it doesn't make any sense. Like half of the world are cocksuckers. You know what I mean? Some of them are women and some of them are men, but like, why is this a bad word? Like anyway.
Yeah. More than half, I guess, really.
Well, I don't know. I guess I'm just assuming that perhaps about the same number of, it's true. I guess if you include people,
well, not all women do that, right?
Yeah, not all women do that, yeah. But over the course of their life, right? Like, so if you're including all bisexual people who have perhaps partaken in that activity in their life, it's definitely more than half.
Yeah, maybe some straight guys tried it once. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, we got off topic there. Sorry.
No, it's great. It was on topic. It was lack of misogyny. We try to have generally a sort of a family-friendly podcast around here, but it is what it is. If it's in the movie, it's going to be in the podcast.
All right. That's good to know.
So before we move along to our sort of concluding, just I want to do a brief fact check on our earlier podcast in our yes or no category, which we will not be discussing today, except for there is, in fact, an early shot in this movie that has two dogs in it. And we previously erroneously stated that there were no dogs in this movie. And I am so grateful that I didn't lose my job over this one because Jim really relies on my being a dog about seeing dogs ability to lock this one up. So I'm glad that I'm able to set the record straight. There is one brief shot with two dogs. There
what
is
about
a dog.
All the players though, who have that dog in them. Don't forget about them.
Yes. You know, Jim, when he hired me, he's seen that on a lot of the grades that people have faxed into him. And so he was like, just so you know, if a player has that dog in him, that's great. But like, don't answer yes to, is there a dog in this movie? Because then I'll be expecting like a four-legged canine and I'll be disappointed when there's not a four-legged canine. There's in fact just like, you know, a player trying really hard. So that was
note.
That was addressed. Maybe Duke didn't talk to you about that at your intake, but it was definitely part of mine. And I was like, great, good to know. So at the end, we sort of talk about some other little favorite and least favorite moments, that kind of thing. So what was your favorite moment of this film?
Well, I will say this. I think the only reason that this isn't my favorite baseball film of all time is that in my heart, I still prefer the romance of the baseball film. Like I still prefer the lack of realism, you know, the movie that makes me feel like I did when I was a kid. And the scene that does make me feel that way is the scene at the end when he gets to play baseball again and he's happy and we see all these other guys who are just like him. I mean, it is so heartwarming to see this person find their place after all they've been through. They deserve their place and they've gone through struggles and they find their place and he gets to play baseball in a park and they're all good and he gets to be challenged and he gets to have fun. I love that moment where Jorge makes an error at third and you know, he had made an error at third earlier in the game in a key spot and it was like the end of his career. And now he makes an error at third and everyone just laughs it off. And it's just a good time at the end of like a very difficult, challenging movie. And I love it.
That's a great pick. I love the very last shot of the film. I found myself thinking about it again and again, where Miguel is sort of laughing. And then there's this moment he goes sort of into the middle distance and his face just goes completely still. And you can see like the little bit of his journey registering on him, right? And then he just lets it go. And he just is talking with his friends and that's the end of the film. And it's like, oh my God, weeping. It's perfect. It's so perfect. What a great choice.
Love it.
Do you have a least favorite moment of this film? Maybe you do.
Not really. I will say, I mean, just the, I get very uncomfortable with the scene at the Bible study because it's a Bible study, number one. And number two, those awkward teenagers make me feel very, very awkward. Those are some of the people I was talking about when I was like, these kids aren't the greatest actors, but you are right that that is what an awkward teenager is like. And it doesn't make me feel good. Also, like, you know, Sugar may be thinking he's about to go to a party and instead he ends up there. Like, that doesn't, that's cringy also. So it's a good scene, but I can't say I enjoy watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You can just feel like their awkward almost gets on you through the television, right? It almost like seeps out and approaches you on the couch. Yeah. It's so deliciously awkward. Mm-hmm. I thought perhaps you were going to use the cocksucker, not to bring that up again, but to use that as your least favorite moment, which I didn't pick a least favorite moment, and I'll go ahead and pick that as my least favorite moment now.
Well, that scene not only has the cocksucker word, but that's also the moment that I pointed out as where his fastball really did not look very fast at all. So there's double problems with that scene.
Yes.
So that's a good call.
Yeah. Although that shot of him walking off the mound as the brawl is happening behind him,
magnificent. Yeah,
perfect, like everything else in this movie. Is there a scene that you'd like to see?
Could you explain this category a little bit? I don't understand what those words mean.
Sure. So that's just like another scene that you want to put into the movie, right? Oh. Like, you get to write an additional scene to put into this film. So sometimes it's serious, as in like, this movie had all of these problems, however, I can slightly fix them by like putting this in, or sometimes it's a joke scene. I think because we came up with some of these things for Major League, I think I came up with this because I just had some wish to see Jake Taylor like driving around in a car for some reason. I don't remember exactly what it was, but like I was just like, I just want to see that. I think that'd be fun. So it can be silly, or it can be like,
How about this? Sugar takes the highway up to Dyersville and visits the Field of Dreams field and has no idea what it is.
Perfect. Great. Excellent. I love it.
Cause I do. Especially, I mean, the fact that this film is set in Iowa is very funny to me.
¿Dónde está Ia?
That's right.
Sort of the bookend to is this heaven? No, it's Iowa. Yeah, perfect. And lastly, our final question: do you have a favorite performance?
I mean, it's Perez as Sugar for sure. I think he's remarkable in the movie. The first time I saw it, his performance didn't pop to me. I was like, okay, he's fine. But then the more I watch it, the more impressed I am with what he can communicate with his eyes. You know, he is at a distance from pretty much everyone in the movie, you know, and in a sense, he's at a distance from us as well, because the filmmakers wisely gave him that respect, I think. You know, they don't try to psychoanalyze him too much. They don't turn him into a test subject. You know, they respect him as a person, and his naturalistic performance, I think, really, really works. A couple other performances I will point out, though. I really do love Raniel Rufino as Jorge. I think he's just a wonderful presence in the movie, and just an important counterbalance. Like, here's a guy who is so comfortable with himself, you know, and comfortable with his lot in life. He knows this is not going to last forever. He's towards the end, but he's still a happy guy, and he's a friendly guy, and he helps Sugar out a lot on his journey. I also really like the people who played his host family parents.
Yes.
I thought they were excellent. And there's that moment in the movie where I don't know how I knew, but you just know that they lost a child at some point along the way. I got that sense so strongly. I don't know if other people do or don't, but there's something in their performance that communicates that to me very strongly that I can't put my finger on. And it's partly due to the filmmakers, but it's also something in a sadness within them that I think they communicate very well.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember the name of the actors who play the Higgins, but they're both so wonderful. Well, there is the reference to their other grandchild fighting in Iraq.
Yes.
But But yeah, I agree that there's something, there's an additional flavor to that scene of like, mm-hmm. maybe this isn't the first time that a child has been in danger of being lost or has been lost. Yeah.
Yeah. I felt that. I felt that very strongly. It was subtle, but it was there.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, going to what you were talking about, Aljenes Perez Soto's performance is like, there's so much, and to me, this is 80 grade acting, mm-hmm. is he's just in whatever he's in. So he's mm-hmm. actually, he's able to express so much because he's not trying to express it and he's not trying to show it. He's just actually thinking what he's thinking and he's just feeling what he's feeling and then just like letting it exist, which is the kind of miracle thing that can sometimes happen for people who are sometimes very new to acting, right? Yes. Like they don't know yet to show something. They just know how to like be in it and inhabit it. And like the rest of us are trying for 25 years just to get to that point of simplicity that he naturally inhabits. So yeah, I mean, I think it's the only real choice for this film. Yeah. But yes, I really appreciate you shouting out some other folks as well. So thank you so much for joining us on this podcast, and thank you to our listeners for joining us to listen to Noah give his scouting grades and also talk about his fantastic book, Baseball the Movie, which you can pick up wherever books are sold, virtually or physically. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating and a review. And before we go, Noah, please tell people where they can find you on the internets.
I'm on the Twitter X at Noah Gattel. I'm on Instagram. I think there's maybe an underscore between my two names there. As I've been going around on my book tour a bit, I've been going to ballparks wherever possible. So I've been documenting that on Instagram, and there'll be some more of that to come for sure. And I do have a website that is noahgattel.com, and you can find all my remaining book events on there, on the events page. So I hope if you like what you hear, and I'm going to be in your neck of the woods, I hope you will come on out to say hello, because I'm having just the most amazing conversations at these events with people. And it's just like, I feel like I've sort of found my tribe, you know, like the baseball movie people are appearing all of a sudden. And if you're one of those people, I'd love you to be there.
Yes. Everyone in the Venn diagram is showing up being like, oh yeah, I'm here. I'm in the Venn diagram. Let's be buds. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being my bud, for finding me in the Venn diagram, even before you put out the siren call of your book for me to come find you. I really appreciate you, your friendship, and you taking the take me into the ballgame amount of time to talk to us today.
Yeah, well, before we go, I feel like you're welcome, first of all, and I feel the same way. I feel like we didn't mention that you are quoted in the book in several places as well. Somehow that we buried that lead, but you were one of the first people I interviewed for the book, because I wanted to just download your entire brain, but instead we had two interview sessions and they were extremely helpful. So thank you for that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, I really feel like it's not about me here. But I didn't know that I was one of your first interviews. And so that makes me feel extra fuzzy and warm in the Venn diagram friendship, weird oval shape.
Yes. 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 It's nice. It's nice in there in the Venn diagram.
It's nice. It's cozy. And so for those of you who are also in that Venn diagram, you can join us again next week for more on Take Me Into the Ballgame. Get back, let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball.